Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
That is why today I am signing a new executive order placing travel restrictions on countries including Yemen, Somalia, Haiti, Libya, and numerous others.
The travel ban is back. President Trump has banned people from 12 countries and placed partial restrictions on seven more. We'll speak to the Center for Constitutional Rights and get an update on Mahmoud Khalil, still in jail in Louisiana. Then the United States has once again vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The vote, 14-1.
The United States has taken the very clear position since this conflict began that Israel has a right to defend itself.
We'll speak to longtime peace activist Kathy Kelly, who's just entered her third week on the hunger strike outside the United Nations.
We want the United States to act with conscience, and if it doesn't, we have to give voice to the shame, the utter shame of prolonging and exacerbating a war whose victims have been over and over and over again children.
Plus, as Israel attacks another hospital in Gaza, we'll look at how the Israeli medical establishment has responded to the targeted destruction of Gaza's medical system. And we'll speak to the British journalist Carol Cadwalader about taking on what she calls the broligarchy.
I think, you know, some people have been talking about the idea that there is now an oligarchy in America, in which incredibly rich and powerful men are now aligning around Donald Trump for their for power, for their own enrichment. And broligarchy is this specific set of tech bros who are acting like an oligarchy, like we saw in Russia around Putin.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump signed a new travel ban barring citizens from 12 countries from entering the United States. A similar ban during Trump's first administration sparked major protests at U.S. airports across the country and numerous lawsuits. The new ban targets visitors from Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and the Republic of Congo, which is also known as Congo-Brazzaville, not to be confused with the Democratic Republic of the Congo. New travel restrictions will also be placed on visitors from Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. Amnesty International criticized the ban as, quote, discriminatory, racist, and downright cruel, unquote. The White House released a video of Trump speaking about the ban.
The recent terror attack in Boulder, Colorado, has underscored the extreme dangers posed to our country by the entry of foreign nationals who are not properly vetted, as well as those who come here as temporary visitors and overstay their visas. We don't want them.
We'll have more on this story after headlines. At the United Nations, the United States Wednesday vetoed another Security Council resolution calling for an immediate, unconditional and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The vote was 14-1, with the other permanent members of the Security Council, Russia, China, France and the UK, all supporting the ceasefire. Palestinian UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour responded to the U.S. veto.
This draft resolution had a simple goal: demanding a ceasefire that would allow the beginning of the monumental work needed to end the horrific humanitarian situation, to stop the genocide, to release hostages and prisoners, and to get the Israeli occupying forces out of Gaza before they get a chance to implement their plans to destroy our people.
Hours after the UN vote, Israel attacked the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City. Three Palestinian journalists were killed. A fourth was seriously wounded. This marks the eighth time Israel's targeted the hospital. Meanwhile, the shadowy new U.S. and Israel-backed aid group, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, has suspended operations for a second straight day after over 100 Palestinians were shot dead while seeking aid earlier this week. This is a survivor.
We only wanted to feed our children. They're the ones who need food, not us. We're used to going without, like during Ramadan. That's why we rushed to the aid distribution site. They tempted people with promises of help, but in the end they opened fire. Why? What did we do to deserve this?
A new CNN investigation backs up eyewitness accounts that Israeli troops opened fire near an aid distribution site Sunday, contradicting denials by Israel. Meanwhile, in southern Gaza, the Israeli military has recovered the bodies of two Israeli Americans, Judy Weinstein Haggai and her husband, Gadi Haggai, who'd been killed in the October 7th, 2023 attack. On Capitol Hill, seven members of the group Doctors Against Genocide were arrested Wednesday inside the Hart Senate office building. The doctors said they were attempting to deliver to lawmakers what they called a prescription to end the forced starvation of children in Gaza. Here in New York, a group of veterans and peace activists have begun their third week on hunger strike outside the United Nations. We'll speak with one of the hunger strikers, Kathy Kelly, later in the broadcast. And in London, pro-Palestinian protesters formed a red circle around the British Parliament Wednesday. Iyas Al-Qassam of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign took part in the protest.
Palestinian lives do matter, and everybody here is saying that if you're a human with a conscience, you cannot watch a genocide, and worse than that, you cannot continue to arm a genocide, and that's why they're here.
In Ukraine, Russian drone strikes killed five people and wounded six others in the northern city of Priluki. The dead included a one-year-old child found under the rubble. Elsewhere, Russian bombs struck the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson, heavily damaging a government administrative building and injuring two people. And at least 18 people were injured when Russian drones struck apartment buildings in Kharkiv overnight, with two children among those injured. The attacks came after President Trump said Russian President Vladimir Putin promised to retaliate for Ukraine's drone strikes on military airfields, which reportedly struck more than 40 Russian aircraft. Putin's threat came during his 75-minute phone call between Putin and Trump, their second call in recent weeks. Trump wrote afterwards, quote, "It was a good conversation, but not a conversation that will lead to immediate peace," Trump said. On Tuesday, Ukraine announced saboteurs had successfully set off explosives planted underwater at the foundations of a key bridge connecting Russia and the occupied Crimean Peninsula. The explosion briefly halted traffic. It was Ukraine's third attack on the bridge since Russia's invasion in 2022. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has rejected a key demand of the Trump administration's proposed nuclear deal, saying Iran must be allowed to continue enriching uranium for peaceful purposes. Over the weekend, the Trump administration proposed a deal that would have allowed Iran to continue enriching uranium, but only temporarily, something Khamenei called unacceptable.
If we have 100 nuclear power plants but no enrichment, it won't help us, because nuclear power plants require fuel. If we can't produce this nuclear fuel within the country, we'll have to turn to America. They may set 10 conditions for supplying nuclear fuel.
Human Rights Watch is calling for an investigation into the U.S. bombing of an oil port on Yemen's Red Sea coast on April 17th that killed 84 people and wounded more than 150 others. 49 of the dead were port workers. Also killed were several truck drivers, two civil defense workers, and workers' family members, including three children. Human Rights Watch said the U.S. government's decision to strike the oil facility while hundreds of workers were present shows a, quote, "callous disregard for civilian lives," unquote. The Trump administration has escalated its attacks on Columbia University. In a letter to the nonprofit that accredits Columbia, the Education Department's Office of Civil Rights asked for the school's accreditation to be canceled. and accuses Columbia of violating the rights of Jewish students by, quote, acting with deliberate indifference, unquote, toward reports of harassment during campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, President Trump Wednesday moved to block nearly all international students from attending Harvard University, taking a separate approach this time after a federal court in Boston blocked a similar effort by the Department of Homeland Security last week. Trump's new effort invokes national security as a rationale. In a statement, Harvard officials rejected the freeze on international scholars as, quote, yet another illegal retaliatory step taken by the administration in violation of Harvard's First Amendment rights, unquote. The Trump administration's proposed cutting funding for tribal colleges and universities by nearly 90%. A move that would likely force most or all of the nation's 37 tribal schools to shut down. ProPublica reports that even before Trump's proposed cuts, tribal colleges were receiving $250 million per year less than the inflation-adjusted amount they should receive. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights once called tribal colleges, quote, the most poorly funded institutions of higher education in the country. President Trump's order doubling tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from 25% to 50% took effect Wednesday. In response, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum accused Trump of violating the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement and said Mexico would soon announce countermeasures.
Si no hay un acuerdo, pues ya nosotros estaríamos anunciando la próxima semana.
If there is no agreement, we will be announcing measures next week. Because our responsibility is first to protect employment, Mexican workers, and second, the steel industry.
The Congressional Budget Office reported Wednesday that President Trump's sprawling domestic policy bill, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, would add $2.4 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. The CBO projects nearly 11 million people will lose health insurance if the proposal becomes law. In New Jersey, Newark Mayor Ross Baracus filed a federal lawsuit claiming false arrest, malicious prosecution, and defamation over his arrest last month by masked federal agents outside an Immigration and Customs Enforcement jail. Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee are calling on Republican Chair Jim Jordan to condemn the actions of Homeland Security agents last week when they handcuffed and detained a staffer for New York Democratic Congressmember Jerry Nadler. The incident began when Federal Protective Service agents knocked on the door of Congressman Nadler's Manhattan offices, demanding to be let in, saying they were searching for protesters. One agent accused Nadler's aides of, quote, harboring rioters, unquote. Staffers have been observing protests outside an immigration court in the same building and invited two protesters inside their office. Congressmember Nadler later told CNN the agents handcuffed and detained his staffer, even though they lacked a warrant.
This was totally unacceptable, and they needed the warrant. And my office is a congressional office. It's a completely separate branch of government, a co-equal branch of government with the executive for which they work. And they had no right to come in. They had no right to disregard the co-equal branch of government, which is to say, the Congress.
And in El Salvador, judges ordered the detention of prominent anti-corruption lawyer Ruth Lopez for 6 months while she awaits trial. She was arrested last month over allegations of embezzlement, charges she says are trumped up. On Wednesday, Lopez shouted to reporters as she was led into a courtroom in handcuffs for a closed-door hearing.
I want a public trial. The people deserve to know. Whoever doesn't owe doesn't fear.
Ruth Lopez is the head of the Anti-Corruption and Justice Unit and Cristosal, a leading Salvadoran human rights group that has frequently criticized the policies of the Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. President Trump has signed a new travel ban barring citizens of 12 countries from entering the United States. A similar ban during Trump's first administration sparked major protests at U.S. airports and numerous lawsuits. The impacted countries are Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and the Republic of Congo, which is also known as Congo-Brazzaville, not to be confused with the Democratic Republic of the Congo. New travel restrictions will also be placed on visitors from Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. Trump linked the new travel ban to the recent attack in Boulder, Colorado, when an Egyptian-born man used a makeshift flamethrower and incendiary devices to attack a crowd of people taking part in a weekly walk to honor Israeli hostages in Gaza. Trump, however, did not add Egypt to the list. On Wednesday night, the White House released a video of Trump speaking about the ban.
Very simply, we cannot have open migration from any country where we cannot safely and reliably vet and screen those who seek to enter the United States. That is why today I am signing a new executive order placing travel restrictions on countries including Yemen, Somalia, Haiti, Libya, and numerous others.
For more, we're joined by Bahar Azmi. He's legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which challenged the first Trump travel ban, along with other groups. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Bahar. Explain the significance of what President Trump did last night.
It's significant on its own, but more so in a continuum with a series of, you know, sort of showcasing almost day by day or week by week, some new immigration policy that, you know, effectuates their sort of evangelical white supremacist fantasy about this country. So there is, you know, this shipping people to Guantanamo, that former security theater, then Seacoat, then coming after Palestinian students. Then attacking, you know, descending ICE onto schools and courthouses. And now this, the a new iteration of a Muslim travel ban that is going to be devastating to families, families from these countries who seek immigration visas or in some cases even tourist visas. And regrettably, the lesson from the last time is that the Supreme Court seems amenable to these claims. The Supreme Court, and really almost only this Supreme Court, seems amenable to claims of the executive that he has enormous immigration-based authority to, quote, secure the borders or, quote, determine what's detrimental to the United States. By excluding people of color.
And so, Bahar, can you explain, you mentioned the Supreme Court. There was a 2018 decision, which people say, legal experts have said, will make this travel ban harder to challenge than the 2017 one.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's right. So people will remember the chaos from the first travel ban. It was particularly tied to Muslim majority countries and the chaos it caused in the airports. And virtually all the lower courts determined like what was very obvious to any human being, which is this was discriminatory. It's discriminatory on the basis of religion and national origin, namely excluding Muslims alone and therefore what should violate the Constitution. John Roberts, as he is wont to do, pretends that what's plain to every sentient human being is not actually the case, finds that it wasn't really driven by racial or religious animus, and then invoke the massive authority that this Supreme Court has given the president to under provisions of the Immigration Nationality Act. To exclude, quote, aliens, exclude non-citizens, even when it seems very patently on the basis of race or religion.
And so, Bahar, can you explain, this particular ban includes exemptions for visa holders and permanent residents. That's unlike the first ban. Do you know why this exemption was put in?
Yeah, this is a little bit less legally a little bit less obviously unconstitutional than the first ban, and includes more countries that are not Muslim majority. It permits claims for asylum, exempts lawful permanent residents, and I think it's just an effort to make it a little bit more tailored legally They perhaps have learned their lesson that they can achieve the shock value and the you know, inflicting trauma on parents and families by doing it in a more tailored way that the Supreme Court would ratify.
I want to ask you about one of your clients, the detained Columbia student protest leader, Mahmoud Khalil, who came up in New York City's mayoral debate last night ahead of a primary election this month. This is one of the leading contenders, State Assembly member Zohran Mamdani.
He should be set free. He should be at home with his wife, Noor, and their young child. And the fact that he is still in Louisiana is an abomination. It's an attack on our First Amendment. And it is clear, another example of Donald Trump weaponizing the very real issue of anti-Semitism to then throw Palestinian New Yorkers into detention facilities and not even tell us what the crime is that they're charged with.
That's Democratic Socialist mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani, who's currently polling second to former New York City Governor Andrew Cuomo, who notably echoed Mamdani and agreed Mahmoud Khalil should be released from detention and, quote, shouldn't have been detained in the first place, unquote. This is a change from Cuomo's response to Khalil's detention in March when he didn't call for the Trump administration to release him and also criticized what he called the anti-Semitic agitators at Columbia. Tell us the latest. You represent Mahmoud Khalil. Talk about what's happening in immigration court in Louisiana and federal court in New Jersey.
Yeah, thanks, Amy, for bringing this up. Yeah, Mahmoud Khalil is one of a number of student protesters who were targeted by ICE. We're nearing almost to the day, the 3-month anniversary of his arrest and abduction by ICE officers in front of his eight month pregnant wife and spirited off to our immigration gulags in Louisiana, a private detention facility in the middle of Louisiana, 5 hours from New Orleans and 1,500 miles from his family. We have a team of lawyers challenging his detention in two forums, in the immigration court, where the Department of Homeland Security is suggesting he is detainable and can be deported because the Secretary of State, Rubio, has determined in an utterly conclusory fashion that his presence in the United States would be adverse to the foreign policy interests of the United States. And when that charge became vulnerable, they added some pretextual and made-up charges suggesting some misrepresentation on his application. In the immigration court, it appears that the Homeland Security has all but abandoned the claim of misrepresentation because it's factually preposterous and is just doubling down on this really chilling Rubio finding that he and other students are deportable just simply on the dear leader's say-so, a kind of Soviet-style diktat. And so separately, we are in federal court in New Jersey challenging the legality, that the unconstitutionality of the Rubio determination as a violation of the First Amendment, and because it's so void, so vague that that it violates basic principles of due process. A district court judge last week found that the Rubio determination as applied to Mahmoud is likely unconstitutional, is so vague and indecipherable that it, you know, can't stand constitutional muster, and invited his lawyers to submit evidence on other questions before the court, namely, how is this causing him harm and what is in the public interest? And last night, we filed an avalanche of evidence on those two points that we'll be making public later this afternoon.
Maher Azmi, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll cover your 2 p.m. news conference. Legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which challenged the first Trump travel ban, along with others, part of the legal team representing Columbia student protest leader, still detained Mahmoud Khalil. When we come back, the U.S. has once again vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The vote, 14-1. We'll speak to well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly. She's just entered her third week on hunger strike outside the U.N.
In dancing pole by pole. My chin breathed into my ears, obey this simple code. When road was paved in gold, when road was just a road. A woeful schism, the pain in our existence was not as I envisioned.
My Blakeyan year, Patti Smith in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
At the United Nations, the United States vetoed another Security Council resolution calling for an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The final vote was 14 to 1. This is Dorothy Shea, acting U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations.
The United States has taken the very clear position since this conflict began that Israel has a right to defend itself, which includes defeating Hamas and ensuring they are never again in a position to threaten Israel. In this regard, any product that undermines our close ally Israel's security is a non-starter. This resolution would undermine diplomatic efforts to reach a ceasefire that reflects the realities on the ground and emboldens Hamas.
Meanwhile, Palestinian UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour criticized the U.S. vote. This was his response.
One would have hoped that these minimal demands that are dictated by humanity, by legality, by morality, would have received unanimous support. But unfortunately, they were faced with a veto.
The U.S. veto comes as a group of veterans and their allies have entered their third week of a fast for Gaza outside the U.N. This is Lieutenant Joy Metzler, an active duty second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force who's applied for conscientious objector status.
The blatant violation of international law, that the U.S. and breaking its own laws. And I joined the military because I wanted to uphold justice. I wanted to protect our country. I wanted to protect people. And really, what the genocide in Gaza opened my eyes to is that the U.S. military or the U.S. military and the U.S. government are just not interested at all in either of those things. And so all of that came together, and I said, I can't be in the military anymore. This isn't what I had been brought up to believe it is. It's the U.S. has been a destabilizing force for years now, and so I'm doing exactly what I had been taught to do, which is stand up for justice. But now I see that standing up for justice means being on this side with all these people out here in this fast who are really fighting, actually fighting for people in the Middle East and in Gaza to be able to lead lives with dignity.
Joy Metzler was approved for conscientious objector status in April.
And this is one of the Fast for Gaza organizers, Mike Ferner. He's the former president of Veterans for Peace.
I was a Navy corpsman during the American War in Vietnam, where we killed over 2 million people. I worked in a Navy hospital and tried to put together the bits of humanity that came back from Vietnam. So I've seen what happens to people in war. And it has never left me. It can't leave me. And so Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, these things happen. And it just tears me up. And not just me, but many, many people all over the world, particularly Veterans for Peace members who have seen what war does. And you can't get that out of your mind. And when you see the hourly feeds from Palestine that we've been getting, you can't take it. I mean, I can understand completely why Aaron Bushnell did what he did. Not many of us have that much courage, but we want to do as much as we can to stop this. So that's why we're doing this fast.
For more, we're joined in our New York studio by another hunger striker, Kathy Kelly's board president of World Beyond War, longtime peace activist, pacifist author, who's been arrested more than 60 times.